You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Welcome. I'm Steve Chiatakis.
This is meine Omi, also die Mutter meiner Mutter.
Angela Thompson thumbs through family pictures in her Culver City living room. She's born in Dresden, Germany in 1941. The pictures she has are black and white. They show her as a toddler with her mom in a park, on the streets, at home. But the smile on her face disappears when the conversation turns to the situation in Ukraine. Current news of grandmothers, mothers, and children seeking refuge in basements and bomb shelters reminds Angela of the time when Allied bombs destroyed her hometown of Dresden when she was just 3 years old.
I remember the feeling in the basement. We always had these warnings when the sirens went off. We were all supposed to go into our basements where we usually would have coals and potatoes and, for the winter and cabbage and so forth. They were not built to really keep the people safe.
For Angela and many others in Southern California with ties to Europe, the war in Ukraine is stirring up memories, changing attitudes, and bringing history alive. The American Cold War with Russia didn't feel especially relevant to many of us just a few weeks ago, but now it's resonating in a new way. Reporter Kirsten Zilm has more.
Angela Thompson's heart goes out to all the children in Ukraine who have to watch their cities being shelled, endure cold and hunger, listen to their frightened parents trying to find a way to safety. The kids will be scarred for life, the linguist and historian says.
Often grown-ups don't think it's so bad for the children and they will forget, except that they never forget. I know everything. I could tell you everything that happened during the night of the bombing of Dresden. And so I look at the children in Ukraine today. They will remember everything. It will never stop for them.
Angela ran through the firestorm of Dresden streets with her grandmother and her mother pushing her little sister's stroller, she says. The women found safety in a park above the city.
A man stood next to me and I saw all the fire around me. And then I said to him, all the houses are burning. And he said, yes, all the houses are burning. I'm sorry, I have told the story many times, but I think that because this is happening again in Ukraine, this is what's making it more difficult for me to talk about it because I thought something like that would never happen again.
Angela and her family escaped from the inferno walking over icy winter streets into East Germany's countryside. They walked for 8 days to find refuge with relatives. 6 months later, Russian troops arrived to occupy the region.
And we had heard that the Russians were ransacking the apartments and the houses and they were taking all the food. And so my grandparents and my parents told me to never talk to Russian soldiers. But the Russian soldiers were very nice to us kids. They gave us candy. They were so friendly. So, of course, I took their candy.
Memories of war and of Russian military power are feeling newly relevant, not just to conflict survivors like Thompson, as Justin Jumpol will be the first to tell you. He is the founder and director of the Wende Museum in Culver City, a historical archive of the Cold War between the U.S., former states of the Soviet Union, and their respective allies. The Wende Museum houses a collection of artifacts, documents, media, and everyday objects from that time. When Jumpol opened the museum 20 years ago, anything involving the Soviet Union seemed to be a thing of the past.
We had to justify what we were doing. And I think I would feel like I had to say something about the importance of learning from our collective past. But in so many ways, a phrase like that is all about something very abstract. Conceptually, intellectually, we connect the past with the present. But with the war in Ukraine, it is very much about the present.
Now, after Russia invaded Ukraine, people come to the Wende Museum looking for answers to their questions about what caused the war. The number of visitors rose significantly in the past few weeks.
One person said to me that she was reading about the war in the New York Times, and she had kind of heard about the museum, but hadn't had a chance to come here. And she said, I put the newspaper down, I got my car, and I went directly to the museum. So there were several impromptu conversations and discussions, and I think that's unusual. We haven't really seen that before. We're standing in front of a statue of Lenin made out of bronze by the Ukrainian artist Bondarenko.
Standing in front of a Lenin statue lying on its back in the museum's light-filled exhibition room, Jampol explains that almost every show at the Vende Museum includes art from Ukraine. Just a few days ago, boxes filled with artifacts arrived from the now besieged country.
It's probably one of the last shipments that we'll get right before the war. One of them is a vase, one of them is a banner, you know, all kinds of things that people send to us. It's also a reminder that these are real people. You know, these are people we work with. Our colleagues, our scholars, our researchers. It's impossible to be completely removed from it.
The museum has adjusted its programming in light of the current events. A year-long series of seminars for students, for example, focuses on the theme of In Search of Truth. Their next session will not be about truth and art, but about truth and war. Curator Jus Siegel.
Of course, also because of all the propaganda and the lies around the warfare in Ukraine. What is it exactly when we talk about truth? And how can we be critical about truth?
The theme of truth and war doesn't feel like a historical concept to Emma Larsen, one of the students attending that seminar series. Larsen is 23, has a degree in history and Russian language, and lived in St. Petersburg for 3 months as a college student. She tutors Russian children in English online and was disturbed to hear a 13-year-old describe the war in Ukraine this way.
He just started telling me that, like, there was no war, it was a military operation, the Ukrainians have to go, like, they're killing. And I was stuck in the space of, like, this 13-year-old telling me these things that I know, at least I think I know, not to be true.
Born almost 20 years after the Cold War ended, Emma is now rethinking her relationship to Russia. Intellectually, she says, she was prepared for an attack on Ukraine.
I was not prepared emotionally. And I think that's the piece that I'm really struggling with. I mean, Russia is this country that I've been enamored with since I was 12. Like, I've become fluent in the language. I've read the books. I've played the music on my cello. And so I'm even going through this emotional truth change of this place I've loved for so long is committing these awful crimes. And, like, what do I do with that?
Meanwhile, the Vende Museum's director is also reevaluating his connection to the region. Before the invasion, Justin Jampol was more interested in Cold War stories others told. Now he wants to learn about his ancestors who fled Russian pogroms in a Ukrainian village that bears his own name, Jampol.
So literally this morning, I was on the maps going through satellite view. And if you look at the satellite pictures, and then you go to street view to see the name Jampol everywhere, the Jampol Bank and the Jampol whatever, I'm seeing my last name all over the town. So it's probably the same street my great-grandparents went on.
He fears the worst for the village more than 6,000 miles away at Ukraine's border to Moldova, where at the moment Russia reinforces its troops and locals brace for being at the center of a new front in the war. For KCRW, I'm Kerstin Sim.
By the way, you can watch the Vende Museum's panel about war and truth tomorrow. That's Wednesday at 4 p.m. and find more information about their programming on their website.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, the Russian invasion of Ukraine has taken countless lives and has displaced millions of people. Here at home in the United States, Ukrainian Americans are watching in horror what's happening to their family and friends. Many are trying to provide what little support they can from afar. But there are some with deep ties to Ukraine who are wanting to do more, perhaps even traveling there, to take up arms and fight for their country. That's what's happening with 47-year-old L.A. resident Dmitry Granovsky, who signed up to fight against the Russians and made that decision because of his 71-year-old Orange County father, who has decided to do the same. And Dmitry joins me right now. Hi there.
Hi. Hi, how are you?
I'm doing okay. How are you doing?
That's a difficult question to answer nowadays, but I can say that as well as can be expected.
What family members, Dmitry, what family members of yours are still in Ukraine?
Well, my cousin Dima in Odessa, he's hunkering down. He's with his girlfriend, and they're doing as well as can be expected. I think they see the writing on the wall, and the Russian army is bearing down on Odessa. And my uncle is with my babushka in Kyiv. My uncle and my babushka I haven't spoken to in weeks, so I'm not sure how they're doing.
That's your grandmother, right, babushka?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. We're going to dig, Dmitry, into your possible scenarios in a moment, but for some context, you were born in Ukraine, right? And your father left for the United States when you were very young. What was that like?
My own personal memories are pretty distant from that time period, but what I recall is going into an office almost daily, my mom usually leaving in tears. Eventually, I came to know that each time we went into that office, it was her begging the person behind the desk to let us go and let us go to America, and so I can see my dad and she can be with her husband. And it was years of no's until one day we showed up, and maybe he was in a good mood. He said, "You can go. You can never come back. Say goodbye to whoever you know here. You're a refugee."
This is when Ukraine, this was the Soviet Union, right? Like, it wasn't really easy to leave the Soviet Union, was it? They called it defection.
It was probably one of the most trying times for my mother. I wish I could have been old enough to be a better comfort to her. But the Soviet Union was not a great place to live. And once my mom had an opportunity to leave, or at least a chance to leave, you know, she was determined.
You all settled with your dad in Texas. You obviously acclimated to American life. How much did you keep up with the day-to-day of what was going on in Ukraine? I mean, that still was your home country, right?
Yes. Well, very little on my end. And part of me chalks it up to a little bit of brainwashing at an early age, because when we came to the States and people would ask, "Hey, well, you know, what are you? Who are you?" I would say Russian, because during the Soviet Union, it was, as far as I knew, it was just one big Russia. And the language that I was taught before we left the Soviet Union was Russian. It wasn't Ukrainian. So that's who and what I identified with. And I did up until 2014. But in that interim, being in Texas in the early 80s, for instance, and it was public enemy number one. We were not the most liked family on the block. We were the Ruskies. We were the ones that were going to send nukes and destroy the world. And even as a kid, I remember feeling some of the brunt of that. It was difficult to be a Russian in the States at that time, I think.
Fast forward a little bit, your family moved to San Francisco, right? Into California.
Yes.
Maybe friendlier a little bit?
Oh, yes. I mean, night and day. I felt accepted as one of the people for really the first time since moving to the States. And I don't blame anyone for that. It's the same us versus you mentality that is prevalent throughout the world.
How surprised, now this is, you know, your father says to you, he's 71 years old, he says to you, I have to do something. I'm going to go back to Ukraine and I'm going to fight. I'm going to take up arms and fight. What, number one, what is your reaction to that? How give us some context to this. How did it happen? When did he tell you this?
The day after the footage of the 24th started appearing on all the news networks. And to say he leaped up from his couch is not an exaggeration. That's literally what he did. And he said, I'm going over there. Now, my dad, just to give you a little bit of context, he's a very passionate man. When he gets something into his mind, he does it. He's traveled, I think, 100 plus countries. Like every month, he'll grab his knapsack and his coat, and he'll go somewhere to and just be a part of the locals. And we respect him for that. About a month and a half prior to the 24th, the invasion, he had brain surgery. He had an aneurysm when he was traveling in Africa, and it almost killed him. And I think when the invasion broke and he saw that footage, now I don't know this for a fact, but I can imagine he was searching for one last meaning in life, something to do 100%, not for any other reason, but to do the right thing. And we all, as best as we could, tried to stop him from going. My birthday is actually on the 24th. I said, please, don't go. Try at least to do this in the right way. President Zelensky issued a call for the foreign territorial defense. Why don't we sign up for that? Why don't we do it the right way? Let's prepare. Let's get whatever equipment we need. I was just trying to slow him down. He wasn't having it. He purchased this plane ticket. And originally it was, I think, for like 5 days ahead. He changed it to leave sooner through Warsaw. He flew out there literally with a backpack, and that's when his adventure began.
You had to have been worried sick when he went over there. Did he go? He went back into Ukraine, or was he? He flew to Warsaw, Poland. Did he find a way back into the country, or what happened?
Yes. So he flew into Warsaw, and the plan was hitchhike to the border, then make his way into Lviv, get a train ticket from Lviv, and go into Kiev from there. That's where I come in. He's never been in a war zone. He's never seen combat. We were desperate to have him not go out there. So I did, the only thing I could do was I gave him an ultimatum. I said, look, you can go to the border. Heck, you can even go into Lviv. Do not go into Kiev. If you go out there, the only thing I can do, the best thing I can do to try to prevent you from going is to go myself. And I shouldn't be out there either. I have no military experience. I have no combat experience, nothing of the sort. But if you go, I said, Papa, if you go, then I'm going to go. And I put that ultimatum out for him.
You did register, right, with the, what is it, the Foreign Services to fight?
Yes. President Zelensky made a decree. If you're a foreign national, we welcome you to come and defend Ukraine. And the process entailed calling the consulate and then emailing them your details. What I hear of, just from my own research, is there's a lot of interest, so they're prioritizing people with military and combat experience. And so that's why I imagine that they never got back to me. But my dad going out there, if I could just say one thing about that, I don't think he really intended to pick up a weapon and shoot someone. When I think of my dad, that is so foreign to me. I can't even picture him doing anything of the sort. So when he went out and crossed the border and got into Lviv and had the train ticket to Kiev, he wasn't able to get there. At that moment, I think it dawned on him that maybe there's a better way to help. He had already been stopped by the military police a couple times. You know, show us your passport. What are you doing here? And I think they perhaps, although he's not very upfront with us about this, they had made him feel a little bad for being out there. You know, walking into the war zone, not knowing exactly what you're going to do, how you're going to help. And so I think at that moment, he really shifted to, let me see how I can help the refugees, the ones that are fleeing the country. And then once he conveyed that to the family, that he was focusing more on the refugees and getting them situated a place to stay in Warsaw, we could finally sort of take a deep breath and we didn't think he was going to go to the front lines at that point anymore.
It should be noted that I asked Dmitry to also have his father on this call with us as well. The dad is 71 years old. Dmitry, you're what, 47? Is that right?
47, yes.
47. Dmitry didn't want to have you didn't want your father to be on the air, right? Because well, tell us what you told me.
The week he spent taking the refugee families that he met at the border into Warsaw and helping them get a place to stay, I think that was one of the most rewarding experiences of his life. And the first thing he said when he came back is, I'm going back. I can't wait to go back. And this time I go to Kyiv. So we're back to square one in a sense, because he's dead serious again. There's the ultimatum that I put out originally, which still stands. You know, how I'm going to help him, I have no idea. I may not even be able to help him. I may not be able to talk him out of it. But as his son, what do I do? Do I not go out and stand next to him?
You have a mother who I'm sure is worried sick, his wife, your mom. You also have a 14-year-old daughter whom you're dealing with as well. What are they all saying? How are they all dealing with this?
They're at a loss. They don't want either of us to go into Kyiv. They understand that my uncle and my babushka and my cousin they've decided to stay. They must stay. We can help in other ways besides putting ourselves into Kyiv. That's their viewpoint. I respect it. I understand it. I share parts of it. But what do I do about my dad? I can't let him go by himself. And that's what it ultimately boils down to. I can't, in good consciousness, let my 71-year-old father go out there alone.
What is it like for you to wait on that, you know, going about your life here in LA with the possibility that, you know, your life may be very different in a few days?
The way I spend my days are nothing like they looked before the invasion. I'm constantly battling thoughts of anger, sadness, just the whole gamut of feelings. I feel like I need to do something, and then I don't know what to do. And then when I talk to my parents, they're just so upset about it. To answer your question, I'm just trying to manage right now.
I want to send seriously the most positive vibes to you and your family. I can't even imagine what you're going through, especially with a father who is you know, hell bent on doing what he's going to do. Wow, what moxie, man! Dmitry Granovsky, resident here in L.A., obviously dealing with some family issues, too, and I want to thank you. God bless you, man. Thank you so much for coming on and telling your story.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on, and we're all going to be okay. We're all going to get through this. Good will prevail over evil, and we need to stop Putin. Thank you so much.
What a story. Whew, that's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, with President Biden's pick for the Supreme Court, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson having a public defender's background, we're going to look at those defenders here in L.A. and how they're doing now after a very stressful time of COVID and huge case numbers. That's tomorrow on Greater L.A. Of course, anytime online at kcrw.com/GLA, and you can get the podcast there as well. Jenna Cagle, Andrea Bautista, Nihar Patel, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordahl all made tonight's show happen. I'm Steve Chitakis. Thank you for your time and attention this evening. Have a great night.